Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Dig, man, there goes Mac the Knife.
This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening What We Did on Our Holiday, Irrational Man, Bikes vs. Cars, Unbranded, Jimmy's Hall, African Grandmother's Tribunal, Trainwreck, and more. And at the E-Bar, Tara Lightfoot and Donovan Woods play on September 24th. And on September 26th, check out That's My Drag. The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. For more information about their hours, listings, blogs, and accessibility, please visit bookshelf.ca.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
If you're hearing this on time and can get to Toronto, please go see Scleris White play a free show at Soundscapes, a music store on College Street in Toronto. Scleris White were on the show. I consider them friends of the show. So go see them. They're playing this free thing. It's like an in-store on the 24th at 7 p.m. Soundscapes. Look it up. You should go. I'm just saying that right now. They're also opening for Godspeed You Black Emperor in Toronto this week as well. So there you are. Great, great group. On this episode, a conversation with some alumnus of the show, Destroyer. Dan Behar is back on the show. This time we're going to talk about his new album, Poison Season, which just came out, and it's remarkable. I'm really a fan of it. It spins my head a little bit. I'm trying to figure it out. Try to get to the bottom of it with Dan, and it's a really good conversation. You'll hear new music from this record as well on this episode. So here it is, myself, Dan Behar. Enjoy. Go see Scleris White. This episode is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph, Ontario. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, or choose from an array of fresh ingredients and make whatever you like. Calzones, wings, panzerotti, salads, breadsticks, garlic bread.
Pizza Trocadero has it all. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph or visit them online at trocaderoguelph.ca. That's TrocaderoGuelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444 for pickup or delivery. That's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade.
The music-making moniker of Dan Behar, a very gifted lyricist and musician who originally hails from Vancouver, British Columbia. He has been creating an idiosyncratic kind of pop music as Destroyer for almost 20 years and can also claim membership in bands like The New Pornographers, Swan Lake, and Hello Blue Roses, among others. His latest work as Destroyer is a startlingly great new album called Poison Season. It's out now via Merge Records, and it's prompted him to tour the world over the next few months, including Canadian stops in Toronto at the Danforth Music Hall on September 30th and in Montreal at Théâtre Fairmount on October 1st. Here now to discuss some of these things is Dan Behar. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I stumbled over my intro. That's never good.
Oh, come on.
It happens to the best of us, I think.
You recovered with grace.
I tried. I'm You're not supposed to point out your mistakes either. And now I'm making another mistake. Where are you, Dan? It sounds like you're near some water.
I'm near a street called Commercial Drive, but there's these little park benches kind of by a community center right off of it. But it's kind of like might still be too trafficy. I just moved to a park bench slightly farther away.
Okay, that's traffic. It's not waves crashing. It's
not waves, man. Okay. No, I wish I could say I was on the Italian Riviera or wherever you want to blue screen us.
People are listening. We could say anything. We could say where you're anywhere, really.
It's true. Yeah, they're powerless against our lies.
This is you're in Vancouver, are you?
Yeah, I'm in Vancouver. I'm at home.
You're at home. That's nice.
And you're leaving soon. So, I mean, this is, I looked at your tour dates and there's a lot of dates coming up. You must be, how do you feel right now when you have all of this travel ahead of you?
Honestly, probably like I feel ill at ease. But kind of excited to like stoked to get on stage, I guess, to actually like to play music for real. That part's good, you know. Am I ready to live on a bus for a month and then take like a week break and then go live on a bus for another a few weeks after that? You know, I'm never quite ready, but you fall into it, you know, like soldier's duty.
Yeah.
You get the hang of it pretty fast.
I ask this because I think that there are certain motifs on the record that suggest, on the new record, Poison Season, that suggest that it could be like a travelogue. There's just a mention of different cities, metropolitan cities in particular, and I was just curious about your relationship to travel, because you don't strike me as someone who would love to be on tour all the time. But at the same time, you seem worldly at the same time.
I feel like I've always taken a certain amount of inspiration from being on the road, maybe, or if, like, from just travel in general. At least when I was younger, when I was writing the record Kaput, I think I took zero inspiration from that and took inspiration from elsewhere. But, I mean, I guess it's possible that Destroyer toured, like, maybe, you know, like 3 or 4 times more than it ever had after Kaput came out. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And I don't know if Poison Season is a travelogue record, but it's definitely like it's a record that involves disorientation.
Yeah, and it evokes certain cities for sure. I can picture them. I can picture famous sites within those cities. You know what I mean? It's a very vivid.
That's cool.
Even I feel like listening to your album, I feel like I've gone on a trip.
That's great. That's good. You know, I think like. You know, it's all quite fictional. I think when making the record, I wanted it to have like a very, you know, I wanted it to have like the force of a film, you know, which is something that can take you into an environment really fast, and in a way that's quite vivid, you know. I think that was important.
I think
there's probably like a certain fleeting element also to the lyric sheet.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the lyric sheet in a little while, but it's interesting that you mentioned cinema, because what I want to ask you about is theatricality. Your new album has been described as theatrical. You've been described as theatrical. Do you like the theater or theatrical things generally?
I'm not sure I've ever seen a play, so I'm not one to I'm not a good person to ask.
You've never seen a play at all in your entire life? Like not in high school, not anywhere?
I kind of remember seeing one in high school. I've seen them less than any human being I know, I think. But I really like reading plays. Maybe it's like my favorite form of literature to read, actually, because it cuts out all the boring shit. And it's forced to take place in a kind of like a poetic world, just because realism on stage seems blown from the get-go, you know? So it has to take place in a universe that's, you know, like just kind of very mythic right away. I don't know though if I'm not a theatrical person. I don't think I am. I think I got into a certain American tradition of songs for the first time ever in my life. I put myself in the American tradition, and that tradition happened to be like the kind of classic early mid 20th century songbook that, you know, has been combed over for like jazz standards and shit like that. What? That also happens to be what people refer to as show tunes, maybe.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Like, you know, and maybe a little, you know, Cole Porter or something, maybe.
Yeah, things like that. Things that have, like, were definitely, like, born of Broadway in the early days. Timpan Alley, I think they called it as well. And I think I got into those songs, I guess, a little bit because I got into jazz records and then I got into jazz singers. And then I discovered that those were the songs that they sang. And I think it kind of infiltrated my singing and even my writing, even though I wasn't expecting that to happen.
I just want to clarify, are you suggesting that you are aware that people are ascribing those things to your new record? Or are you sort of coming clean and saying those are things that maybe do inform this record?
I would say that I think people make... I think people make those leaps, and I also think that I got into those songs for the first time ever. So yes, they do. They do inform the record.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to I want to be clear on that. Now, do you?
Yeah.
Knowing what I know of your influences, people you've cited, people that I hear within your work, I think that you are drawn to people who make grand gestures in their music. Whether that is, you know, you used the term mythical earlier, and sometimes I think that you are among the songwriters I can think of that apply mythical tone within your lyrics. Like something, it's storytelling, but it also seems fantastical or something. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this notion that rock or pop music might just be inherently theatrical. I know you say you don't think of yourself as theatrical. You've not seen a play, really, but do you think that this form or the forms that you're exploring maybe have an inherent theatricality?
I don't really know. I don't think so. I mean, usually when I listen to pop music these days, all I hear is, like, the lyrics, what people are saying just strikes me as, like, the utmost banality, which generally is what we think of as the opposite of, like, myth-making or like a kind of arch, like poetic attack to speaking or singing or art making, you know, like it couldn't be more every day.
Well, you know, you're talking, you're talking lyrically. What about performance wise?
I don't know. Performance wise, I think it's too divvied up, you know, like there's what's recorded or the song. And then I guess there's what you do with it, but just because you take your song and you perform it in front of like the most amazing 4th of July fireworks display, it doesn't make it any more grand, you know?
Hmm. So you don't think that, I mean, I think that when I listen to people like, I don't know, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie, I feel like they are, some of their work is informed by these grand dramatic gestures.
Yeah, no, it's true. I guess I was thinking of like super popular things that are super popular right now. I'm probably like just blanking on stuff that's a good example of what you're talking about.
Have you heard of Meatloaf?
I have, actually. I know much more about Meatloaf than I do about Bruce Springsteen, that's for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you suggesting you're just not a Bruce Springsteen fan, and you're not saying you're a Meatloaf fan, you just don't know anything about Bruce Springsteen?
I mean, I don't know Bruce Springsteen's music. While I know the record Bad Outta Hell, I think, quite well, or like I know Jim Steinman's songs probably a lot better than I know the songs of Bruce Springsteen.
Interesting. Have you sat down with Born to Run, the album Born to Run?
I know some of the bigger songs off of it, but generally I can't. I don't get through a whole album of his.
Not a fan. Not a fan at all.
Not really a fan. No.
Interesting.
Okay. There's elements that I like, but it's like it's kind of like I never know when I'm landing myself in hot water anymore. But I was gonna say there's this kind of like Italian operatic Jersey version of like Dylan that I do like or I find like entertaining that Springsteen does.
Yeah.
It's very like operatic but still harboring this interest in you know, like in some ways surrealist imagery and American imagery.
Epic American imagery.
Like, you know, like he really likes Bob Dylan, but I think there's super key important things to Bob Dylan which have completely gone over his head.
Well, but there's also within that particular record that I'm describing, sure, he likes Bob Dylan, but he also likes Phil Spector. He also likes, you know, he likes Motown. I mean, there's that stuff. It is a very American listening
experience. It's true. It definitely works as pop music in a way that's way more effective, I think, than like Dylan or Van Morrison, which is probably the stuff that he was really into when he first started, you know?
Yeah. Well, I bring him up not to dwell on him, because, certainly if you're not a fan, but there are moments on your record that there's the song Dream Lover that really recalls Springsteen. And I like when this happens, when I hear a thing in an artist and they say, never heard of him or never listened to that guy.
No, but I do know, I mean, I obviously have heard of Springsteen, but yeah, I don't put on his records, you know, I don't play them. I know, like, there's some auto, there's like kind of like an automatic nerve reaction that happens when people hear a wailing sax. I think, like,
oh, that could be it. You're
I think a lot of things could remind someone of Clarence Clemens, and then that, you know, without actually having the song sound Springsteen-esque. But you'd have to take that up with Joseph, and I intend to. The minute I see him tomorrow.
This is Joseph Chabison. I remember he went to do these sessions for Poison Season, and then I saw him shortly thereafter, and he said it was wild. He said it was the Destroyer music that was being made was mind-blowing to him.
Well, I mean, I think Kaput was such a casual thing for him. Like, he just came in and had never heard the songs and just kind of soloed all over them for a couple hours, and that was it, you know? Mm-hmm. And we just went cherry-picking later on when we were mixing the record. And this was kind of different, you know? There was, like, we wanted kind of more bona fide layered arrangements for a lot of the songs, and you know, we rang him dry.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, he sounded pleasantly. He was pleased to be exhausted, I think, when he got.
Yeah,
back.
I think it was a tiring weekend for him.
Yeah, but I think he enjoyed it. I mean, when I spoke with him, he really enjoyed it. Now, we've talked about theater a little bit. We've talked about, you've brought up film. I'm curious, again, I don't know if we're going down a weird path here, but what about musicals or Bollywood film? Do you relate to song-driven narratives at all?
Yeah. I guess I have more of a history with that stuff than most people do. I have really early memories of my parents watching those films. And so I do have a history with that stuff in ways that many people I know have no history. In fact, they see it as like maybe the most aberrant, shitty art form that exists. And I am very hard pressed to talk them out of that stance. You know, I got to be honest, but it's in there. It's in me, and I don't deny it.
Well, there's something so strangely, it's packaged as this pleasant thing, but musical is about the most surreal form I can think of.
Just makes no sense.
It makes no sense. I grew up having to watch, I don't think we called them Bollywood films at the time. We just called them Indian movies. And,
yes.
And it was weird. There's every movie seemed to be 3 or 4 hours. And every fight was punctuated by a song and dance sequence. And none of it made
it. So cool.
It is cool. But I mean, at the time, I was just like, what the hell is this? Like, I don't understand. And so, I don't know, I was just wondering if any of those conceits informed Poison Season. Like, it sounds like you have the show tunes thing that you were immersed in, and then now I'm based on this last answer, it sounds like within you there is this musical thread, and I'm trying to, you can hear me, I hope this feels like a valiant struggle and not just a desperate one. I feel like there's something in this record that I'm trying to unpack, and it's...
I mean, those things are there, and they've probably been there for a long time, you know? It's just that I think Poison Season is probably the most blatant example of me just making a record that is just, like, quite literally just the kind of shit that I like, you know? It's like, it's very simply laid out as this is what I'm into, unabashedly. So, I mean, there's something in my upbringing that maybe exposed me to that stuff. But I mean, really, the thing I kept thinking about before I got started actually making the record was like the song Mac the Knife.
Huh.
And Three Penny Opera. And it's also the way that song got watered down and Americanized into like this kind of like swinging light jazz standard. But that song is like such a dark song, like such a gnarly song. And my first plan was to try and cover it. It was going to be like the first song on the record. And I never could figure out a way to sing it. But that has a lot to do with the things I was thinking about. And then there's other songs that are just like, you know, just me being really obsessed with like Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane's version of Lush Life, or a couple versions of like I Love Zoo Porgy, which is a song that kind of tears at me. I don't know why. So, you know, those are kind of like within a musical tradition, but they're also not exact. It's not exactly Oklahoma. It's different, you know. It's like the Hollywood aspect of it doesn't really interest me. And I don't think that's what I chased after.
It seems to me, based on what you're saying, that you seem to have become interested and fascinated by interpretation, by misinterpretation, by people taking or adapting other people's work or absorbing it in ways that maybe possibly skew the intent of the original. And I'm curious about that, and you're... It just seems like you're kind of railing against, I don't know, false reproduction or something.
I don't really know. I don't think there's any, like, I don't know what the politics of it are. I know I started getting into the idea of singing songs that were out there in the world, you know? It probably first started after Kaput came out, and I was just like, you know, I'm really just going to explore the idea of me as a singer. You know, I made this short record of me singing some Spanish language covers.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I think it was a part of me, as a way to not get too hung up on my own writing, you know? And I thought it was important to think of, to be a singer first and a writer after that, or like, for me to write the kind of material I'd like to sing, but for that not to be the kind of be all end all of it. And that's maybe when I got more and more into like these kind of vocalists who didn't write their own stuff. It kind of predated like the rock era and just interpreted things, but made them very much their own and had like a style that was so honed in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is also straying into this notion of theatricality in the sense of being an actor, being someone who is taking someone else's thoughts and ideas and intention and sort of conveying them for them, being an interpreter, being a conveyor of something. I know that you mentioned the Spanish language record. I mean, I'm curious how much thought you've actually given putting out a covers record now that you know you're very established and have developed your own voice and phrasing and perspective. It would be fascinating to me to hear you make a covers record.
Yeah, I think it would be cool, you know. But I, like, for some reason, when I did the five Spanish songs, I really wanted to kickstart something, you know. I needed to get back into the studio. I felt like it had been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have my head wrapped around what few songs I had written should sound like. And I didn't really have that many songs. But I felt like singing, and I felt like doing it in like kind of like the most natural way possible.
Right.
Bizarrely enough, that would be not in English, but, yeah, I don't know. I don't have much experience singing other people's songs because I've I've maybe internalized too much the idea that my voice is kind of strange and just part and parcel of the weird words I write, and maybe doesn't work outside of that. But I think I'm busting loose of that slowly, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of busting loose, I want to ask you about some of the movements in these songs, because I've been struck by many of them. And I'm going to home in on one thing, and I just want to get your interpretation about the arrangement for the song Forces from Above, because I like it. I like the way it moves. It goes, you know, for people who haven't heard it, it's a weird one, and I want to hear what you have to say about it, Dan. Someone's peeling out right there.
Yeah, I know. they left someone else in the dust. That was one of the earliest songs, you know, and I think there's like one or two songs which are kind of remnants of when I still thought it was important to be genre specific, kind of. What I mean by that is that there was a point where I thought I should make like a disco salsa record or a salsa disco record. I don't really know what the term is, but
it sounds delicious. It sounds like something I'd like to eat. Yeah.
something that tastes good. But something very Latin influenced that is very danceable.
Sure.
And Forces from Above started like that. But it kind of morphed into something, I don't know, like just a lot more ragged and sinister.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Sounding, but still with this kind of triumphant ending, you know. Yeah, I don't know, it's a weird song, and it's like one of the songs that's not really just the band live off the floor. It's kind of built of a lot of disparate parts, like between the kind of frenetic percussion that happened and then the kind of band's take, what the band laid down on top of that,
right?
And then what the string quintet did like months later after that, you know, like the string arrangement that Stefan came up with, and all together it just kind of turned into this like strange hushed beast, you know.
Yeah, and it just goes in weird, it seems to be going in a direction that makes sense, and then towards the end it swells into something else completely.
Yeah.
So I it's interesting that this was one of the earliest compositions, because when I hear it, knowing that, it feels like it's some amalgam of what the album was intended to be and what it became.
I think the song changed a lot over the course of a year, you know, because at one point I wanted it to be just like a kind of a groovy song with weird lyrics, but then I don't know, when I laid the vocals down and when Josh laid his parts down, just the way the band played it, there's just like a kind of a tension that ran all the way through it, and started to be much less of a feel good number, which in the end really suited my purposes for this record, because I didn't want to make a feel good number.
Right. Even though you were conjuring show tunes potentially and whatever other musicality was within you. Like there is a kind of an uplift to some of the stuff you're drawing from.
I think so. I mean, you can use those forms, but still, I mean, you can be as downtrodden as you want within any form, really,
yeah.
I think, you know?
What was the process?
All that stuff is just me.
It is, yeah, yeah. I hear what you mean. I hear what you're saying there. What was the process like to bring the string and orchestral arrangements sort of out of your head and into real life? We mentioned a few of the people that you worked with, but how did that work out exactly?
That's pretty weird, you know? It happened very independently from the rest of the music. So there was definitely like an element of anticipation and suspense. And if this doesn't work, we're fucked. Because at that point, I had kind of given a lot of weight to the importance of the string arrangements, and I still do. I really felt like they were something that was like at the heart of the record, you know?
Yeah.
And it was also totally outside of my control, because I don't speak that language, you know, when a bunch of like classical musicians come into a room to punch the clock for 4 hours and read their charts, they're either going to nail it or they're not, you know? I definitely didn't feel like I had the ability to guide the proceedings. And Stefan's arrangements, I knew were going to be different takes on the songs than what I would have come up with, or even the feel of what the band laid down, you know, because that's kind of why I asked him. I knew he didn't really have much interest in, you know, being like a pop music string arranger. It wasn't his background. I knew that there would be like definitely in a lot of spots some kind of, you know, dissonance from, or like between like the natural state of the song and his vision of it. But in the end, I really loved that. It created like a lot of like really cool head scratching moments for me.
That's weird. You just basically, I mean, I've had friends who've done this as well, because on some level, I feel like string arranger people are basically like mechanics or any other specialist that you have to call in when you're like, I can only do so much here. I can't fix my fridge. I need to get someone. And they tell you what's going on and you have to trust them. And I don't know if you wrote these arrangements or if you just said, go for it. And
no, I just sent him like some demos with they had like a couple melodic motifs attached, and he just went for it. And I mean, the arrangements don't show up one like completely intact, you know. There was like mixing on our part involved, and you know, a bit, some editing here and there, but they're pretty true to form, you know. But I knew that he also wasn't going to be someone who did like a kind of a workman's job on it. It was going to be, I don't know, it's going to be more out there than that.
Yeah. No, it sounds lovely. I'm curious to know how you will bring this to life live, unless you're bringing a string section with you.
Really not supposed to talk about it. I mean, like,
what? Do you mean, what? Because of because of the government? Why not? Why can't we talk about it? Am I?
I think it comes up, and I guess my answer has always been, yeah, we're gonna figure it out. And in the end, I don't know. We got one more practice left. We'll see what happens.
Oh,
we're not touring as a 13 piece, to answer your question.
Right, yeah. That's what I mean. And you're upset by the fact that people bring it up because it puts pressure on you and these songs?
Not at all. I'm just joking.
Okay.
I just think it's like, it's definitely been something that's, you know, forced us to rearrange things and attack the songs in different ways. And I think that's good. Like replicating things has never really been the Destroyer forte live.
No, of course not.
And you know, they add a lot to the songs, those arrangements, but at the same time, I feel like once we're on stage, things are just mostly like, I don't know, if they feel good and they sound good to us, then we do it. And if it's sounding bogus, then we ditch it.
To be clear to people who maybe haven't yet heard the record, this is not a fully formed, austere, classical record. I mean, it's also really a rock record.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there's definitely maybe more than any other Destroyer record, you could feel like the real, like the presence of an actual band at work over the course of a few, like, of a series of songs, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like, probably what we'll steer into on stage, because that's kind of what made me want to do this record in the first place, was like the sound that we whipped up in 2012 playing a shit ton of shows together. You know, my mind kept going back there and wanting to record that and document that. And that's like really the bulk of what Poison Season is.
Yeah, yeah. Am I wrong in thinking that Poison Season is a relatively sparse record in terms of language and your voice generally? It feels like you're kind of consciously holding back here and there. Am I off the mark?
I think so. I'm not totally sure. I didn't use my word countometer on it, but I feel like there's maybe more going on than there was in Kaput. Though Kaput had a couple songs like Bay of Pigs and Suicide Demo for Kara Walker that had reams of words, and maybe Poison Season doesn't really have that.
Well,
there's a lot of restraint in the vocals, but I don't know. I feel like, and they're kind of quiet in a lot of ways, but I feel like, I don't know. I was hoping that there was like a quiet intensity to them.
It seems like the words come in batches, or like there's a fluttering, a smattering of words, and then they disappear for potentially a minute or two, and then they come back.
Yeah.
And it just struck me that that's not, I don't know. I mean, I think you've done all sorts of things, so it's hard to say that this is definitively different, because you've made very dynamic records, as you say. But I just wondered about it. It seems to suit the tone, and I guess maybe I don't want to use the word drama, but it seems to suit the arc of the songs to kind of come in and out the way you have been. So I just wondered if that's just part of it. Is it a narrative device? Is it something from, I don't know. I was just curious about it.
I think that's like just the way I'm going. That's just the path. I could be wrong, you know. I say all sorts of things, and then they end up different. But it's, you know, you're not wrong to say it's vastly different from how I was writing and singing 10 years ago, when we were making, you know, Destroyer's Rubies or some record like that.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, definitely into, giving the music like room to breathe and creating space in it, and having the vocals be like kind of more of a formidable presence and a constant presence, you know. And there's like something maybe more intimate about this approach in a lot of ways.
Well, you also have, I'd say, comparably minimal voice, and then, relatively speaking, a rather dense, lush musical bed for you. You know, you mentioned having a real live band with you and all these strings. And yeah, it's weird, man. It's weird. I think at the end of all of this, I just think it's weird. And I'm trying to figure it out. I like it a lot, but I think it's weird.
I think it's a pretty strange record, too. You know, it's like, I really like it. It sounds like the style of record that's closest to me, you know?
Yeah.
But it's also, yeah, like very kind of strange. It's just like, in some ways, like a very placid and resigned kind of singing. In other ways, the record seems like completely unhinged.
Yeah, it's totally strange.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very much an emotional roller coaster or something. I don't know how to describe it. Some of us anyway, have been thinking a lot about America over the last, particularly the last little while. It's been a volatile place, and you, as a marker on your record, sing quite a bit about Times Square, or at least that when I hear it, I'm thinking of the most famous Times Square. And I was curious, as a place and a concept, what does What does Times Square represent to you?
I don't know. I never gave it a second thought till I wrote that song, you know? I was just kind of like strumming the song. I hadn't picked up the guitar in years to write a song. And I started kind of making up this song on the spot that had like a very, you know, kind of 70s Lou Reed style.
Yeah.
Kind of lope to it. And I don't know, I got to this like, I got to this part where it's like you could fall in love with something and Times Square just blurted out of me. And I think at the time I was thinking of just like, I was thinking of a grotesque or like a really backwards thing for someone to fall in love with, almost like something that was impossible to fall in love with.
Yeah, there's incredulity, you know? And sarcasm and yeah, shock.
It's when kind you of like, yeah, there's like, it's kind of like bitter, but like kind of applauding at the same time, you know. It's like a heroic gesture of falling in love with something that's just like impossible to love. And also maybe morally wrong to love, because like when I think of Times Square, when I take a step back, I just think of like in its current state, just like gain unchecked, you know, just like this ridiculous hyper symbol of American capitalism or something. And to imbue that with some kind of like romantic sentiment, you know, it seems like totally fucked, but kind of I don't know, it seemed like it instantly seemed to mean a bunch of things at once, which I kind of like, you know. And it just was also really fun to sing, if you know. Yeah. This is usually the bottom line about anything, you know. It's like, it was like really fun to spit out in that way. Like the words struck me as really odd and distinct side by side, which is weird for an expression which is just like so everyday and, you know, something that's just like been around my whole life.
Yeah, when I heard the song,
like looking at, you know, like looking at something for the first time and it's like, and it strikes you as you've seen it a million times, but for some reason you look at it and it seems like you've never seen it before.
Well, that's interesting. That's the interesting thing about Times Square. It has evolved so much in my lifetime. You know, before I could even experience it, it was basically a cesspool of pornography and homelessness, and it was crime ridden and hard. It was thought of as a hard part of New York, and
yeah,
with various shifts in mayoral leadership, it got cleaned up and sanitized, and strangely now it's a beacon. It's weird.
Yeah, I guess the fact that it's gone through so many versions of itself, you know, was something that I liked, especially because like as a kid I just associated it with this kind of Taxi Driver version of New York.
Yeah totally.
And Taxi Driver is like a movie I'm really into, as far as like, well, I love the soundtrack and I just love the physical quality of the movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's something that I think I was actually probably more than like Fellini movies, which I also, or like 8.5 for La Dolce Vita, which are movies I was thinking a lot about when making Poison Season. I think Taxi Driver is like something that I was thinking about a lot as well. And just like Times Square being the original home of, you know, kind of like 1920s kind of Broadway glitz and glamour, and then what happened to it after the war, how it just like kind of became dissolute and then cleaned up in the late 80s and 90s, you know.
I'm starting to get the sense that whether you like it or not, there's all this, something is magnetizing you to New York with Broadway.
I don't know.
It's strange.
It seemed like the record had something invested in every single one of those eras.
Yeah.
Though I'd never really thought about it until just saying it right now. But
and you've never lived in New York? You don't have a particular affinity for New York?
I mean, I spent some time there, like 14, 15 years ago. I've never lived there. I've never gone out of my way to go there. I don't think about it. So I think, you know, a lot of people, because the song happens three times, thought that it was like a real, like, kind of linchpin for the record, which isn't really the case. You know, that happened for very specific reasons.
Well, it's fine and dandy for you to say that, but I think the fact that it appears three times makes it significant. I don't think
you're probably right about that.
You can say whatever you want to me, but I have the evidence that it's significant because it's on the record three times. So, yeah,
I guess, I mean, I guess you're right. I know what it's doing there, and I know that it's not like I wrote the rest of the record around that song, but I guess it is the framework of the album. That, I guess, that much is undeniable, just because it's laid out for anyone who wants to listen to it.
No one can argue that. Yeah, it's true.
No, I can't. I cannot even argue it myself.
Least of all you. Yeah, you can't. Yeah. You're not going to win.
So,
no,
yes, for me, it's like it. When we laid out, when we split the orchestral version in half and laid out the record the way we did, things just really came into focus. And it felt good, so it has that power at least.
I think it works. I think there's something going on that you and I are not going to be able to figure out tonight. But I think there's something going on this record, and this helped. This helped me a little bit. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Appreciate the time.
All right, man.
What's next for you? What's going on with Destroyer beyond the touring?
I think in about 5 minutes, maybe less. My wife and daughter are going to pick me up off this street corner.
Uh-huh.
And in about 36 hours or something, I'm going to get on a tour bus and disappear for a month and then come home for a few days and then fly off to Europe and do the same thing.
Right.
And after that, I can't say. I want to do a whole lot of nothing. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Well, once again, the new Destroyer album is a brilliant one. It's called Poison Season, and it's out now by Merge Records. And he's touring the world over the next few months, as you just heard, including Canadian stops in Toronto at the Danforth Music Hall on September 30th and in Montreal at Théâtre Fairmount on October 1st. More information about all of these things, please visit mergerecords.com. Dan, before we go, is there a song from Poison Season we can go out on that you would like to select?
I like the song Bangkok.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
Yeah.
Why do you like that
song? I don't know. I really like the ending of it. And I really like the ending, and I feel like I sing it in an assumed kind of voice, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a character piece. And I don't know if I've ever written one of those before, and I don't know if I'll do one again. So it has that. It kind of has a novelty factor for me that way.
Yeah, I
like it.
You might say it's theatrical.
I would say it's the one song where I would definitely have to concede to you that it definitely has like a theatrical element to it that is undeniable.
I hope we're not fighting. I just hope this has not become a fight. This is
no way. It hasn't.
This is Bangkok by Destroyer. Dan. This was always, you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I like chatting with you. Thank you for being back on the show, and best of luck going forward.
Likewise. We'll talk to you soon.
Like you, I've been around the world, seen a million girls. I see Bangkok. I've seen Bangkok. Black, blue, red, white, Z, all very nice. like you've been around the world, worn a million pearls. I see Bangkok. Your dark birds in flight, bring out your red roses too. Hey, what's got into Sunny? Bring out your dead, bring out the light, bring out your dark birds in flight, bring out your red roses too. Hey, what's got into Sunny? Bring out your dead, bring out the light, bring out your dark birds in flight, bring out your red roses too. Hey, what's got into Sunny? Your dead, bring out the light, bring out your dark birds in flight, bring out your red roses too. Hey, what's got into Sunny? Oh, what's got into Sunny?
There you have it, Bangkok, from the new Destroyer album, Poison Season. I hope you enjoyed that song. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dan. It's always fun to talk to Dan. He's a thoughtful guy. Hey, you can subscribe to Creative Control with Vish Khanna on iTunes. You can listen to it and like it on audioboom.com. You can go to patreon.com to make a flexible monthly donation to the show. Keep it going. And you can also go there to view the t-shirts that I have for sale for the show. You can also like and be a part of this show's Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter, @VishCreative, and you can listen to the show on, or at least a version of this show, on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on CFRU 93.3 FM if you're in Guelph or the KW region. Also, you can listen to it anywhere in the world at CFRU.ca. It's mostly this show, podcast version, but sometimes it's different and exciting and interesting, and there's a lot more music sometimes. So check it out. That's it for me. Just an update. If you've been on the Facebook page or followed the Twitter, I'm working on this Drive Like Jehu documentary. It's very close to being done. I'm just going to finish a section and then give it a couple more passes. It's one of those things where every time I listen to something, I want to fix it. And that can only go on for so long. That's why it's nice having the deadlines. You just put it out and hopefully it's good. But I'm tinkering with this thing, but before long there will be a Drive Like Jehu documentary that I'm very proud of and excited to share with you. It's the first of what I hope will be a series of documentaries that I produce for this show, so stay tuned for that. And another upcoming guest to tell you about, FFS, Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand and Russell Mail of Sparks. Those two bands are together. They're FFS. They're going to be on the show sometime soon as well. So there's a little update. That's it. All right. Take care. Talk soon.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.